After the previous three commenters, my field is more restricted. I have to try to restrict myself a little more by making three sorts of preliminary comments. The first, at least, may be a bit obvious, but maybe not. I simply want to underline that I am not one of those who believes that Foucault can be generalized into some category of post something or another, post this, post structuralist. I don't think it can be fixed that way for a number of quite important reasons. It fixes a unity on what is a broad diversity of positions that have been out there under the label of critical analysis. Because it fetishizes Paris, really the 1960s or 70s, a particular generation of the avant-garde, in a way which fixes Foucault, etc., somehow exotic, radical, different, alternative to something which is assumed to be normal, mainstream, Anglo, uncritical. And not least because it ignores a wide range of other debates. Warren's referred to some of them. In the English world, the ones I would want to emphasize are actually German. Particular German traditions which have worked their way through some of the peculiarities of French intellectual culture. So first I want to rescue Foucault from the categories of postidom, perhaps to situate him, nevertheless, as one of many people struggling to think about what it means to make claims about change in relation to a modernity that already knows all too well what change must mean and in what direction it is going. Secondly, although having been called a Foucauldian on many occasions, and I think this is one of the least objectionable labels I've been called, he's not someone I've ever thought of myself as following specifically. Although I have, I would admit to following many of the people from whom Foucault himself learnt. And in particular, I think of people who actually taught Foucault, Gaston Bachelard, Georges Canguilhem, Pierre-Maxime Schull, Louis Althusser, amongst others, as well as the kind of philosophers that he seemed to have been struggling with in most of his works. I suppose I would single out Nietzsche, Husserl, and Heidegger. So again, I would say it's necessary to put Foucault into some broader context. This is again quite obvious, but not an easy thing to do. And much of the context in which Foucault himself was struggling to think has been lost to us, especially, I think, as he's come down to us now in the modern social sciences. And thirdly, of course, there are many problems interpreting Foucault, as there are problems interpreting anyone. And not least in relation to the claim made by Foucault himself that there are indeed three Foucaults. And Jim referred to these, the archaeological, the genealogical, and the period dealing with various techniques of the self. Now here there are all kinds of questions, for example, about whether one understands this as some kind of development in Foucault's thought, or the application of a more or less similar question to different objects and through different methods, or, as I think I prefer, an oscillation between possibilities that are already given in this formulation of the question. So I go for an oscillation theory of Foucault's internal development, not particularly a development theory of his development. And then, of course, there are all kinds of problems trying to get some connection between the many different empirical, historical objects of analysis in which he was engaged, and what might be called some attempt to find his central question. In this context, I'm really reminded of one of the analysts of Max Weber, who kept insisting that we know less about the generation of Max Weber than we do about Thomas Hobbes. And one of the problems in interpreting Weber is we have a hard time getting to terms with Weber's central question. And in some respects, I think we have a similarly difficult time trying to come to terms with Foucault's central question. And different people, of course, have different ways of trying to suggest that a particular kind of question is at the heart of Foucault's analysis. Yesterday, Jim Talley offered a reading of Foucault centering on an underlying concern with human agency. By contrast, Arthur Croker offered a more structural reading of changing historical conditions, but put into some question the contemporary relevance of Foucault's struggles with agency. In some sense, I might even read this opposition between agency and structure as central to the general problem with which Foucault was himself concerned, keeping in mind that, as Warren rightly warns us, these are not specifically French preoccupations. So I'm personally more persuaded by claims about continuity and oscillation in Foucault's thought than by claims about three different Foucaults. And consequently, I've been more interested in his earlier work, especially down to the Order of Things, as well as those texts in which he recognizes that sovereignty is a more difficult problem than he sometimes seems to think. And thus I'm especially interested in the texts around Society Must Be Defended, about which I won't say anything today. Which is to say, I'm interested in Foucault because I think he's provoked by some of the same problems that provoke me. Which, of course, is to insist that invocations of the name Foucault are always likely to say more about those who invoke the name than about the complexity to which the name is given. So just two comments about problems. A general point about the need to understand the problems people are grappling with. For some, like me, problems or questions are more interesting than answers, not least because specific framings of a question will largely shape what is considered to be a plausible answer. There are, of course, many well-known problems involved in understanding the problems driving particular writers, and not least in the way historians and political theorists tend to be pulled in different directions on this matter. Suffice to say that in the end, I view Foucault as someone involved in a broader process of re-articulating questions about what it means to ask questions about contemporary political life, given the largely over-coded and repetitive character of the answers given to the standard questions of modern philosophy and politics. And this may be why some students find Foucault frustrating. He does not give easy answers. This is one reason I actually admire him. I admire him a lot. Ask a silly question and you will get a silly answer. Answers are very easy. There are a lot on offer. Answers, I would say, are cheap. The problem, of course, is to know what a non-silly question is. It's actually quite hard to work this out, given the tendency to fix everyone into some sort of ism, which is to be consumed on the shelves of postage in order to provide some kind of answer to the great problems of our time. But what exactly are the great problems of our time? I'm not going to tell you. At the same time, it is clear that Foucault has become a figure that a great many different people can appreciate as someone who is struggling with the problems that drive them. Here I would say that I'm struck by a certain similarity between the proliferation of Foucaults that can be found in contemporary literatures and the proliferation of Kant's, who came to populate various neo-Kantianisms that had such an impact in the late 19th century. This was when it became clear that, while there remained much to be said for Kant's attempt to insist on the importance of the constitutive categories through which modern subjects could impose coherence on phenomena, and thus to his claims about the naivety of both empiricisms and rationalisms claiming to be able to know the world as such, and further about his claims about the need to promote critique and resist dogmatism, Kant's own resort to transcendental or quasi-transcendental guarantees for the categories that had become subject to increasingly radical skepticism. Basically, the Newtonian categories of space and time that Kant had assumed as the a priori conditions of knowledge, conditions of human knowing, lost their status as either transcendental or quasi-transcendental universal. The late 19th century is rather lost on us these days, not least because of people like A.J. Eyre, who simply want to go straight back to the English empiricists and to forget about the extraordinary complexity of late 19th century, early 20th century debates about the fate of reason given the collapse of the transcendental guarantees. The problem was not too much metaphysics, but that metaphysics was indeed becoming very, very difficult, much easier to do the English common sense. I think it's very useful to consider many of the debates in which the name of Foucault has been invoked as a harking back to the period in which various attempts were made to historicize, sociologize, and culturize the constitution of knowledge production in ways which were shaped by logicians quite as much as by classical social theorists. This is part of the background shaping Max Weber's sociology, Karl Mannheim's sociology of knowledge, and so on, and what is usually known as the attempt to understand a historical a priori rather than some transcendental or quasi-transcendental a priori. The point of invoking this period here is twofold. While Foucault is now framed as the radical, attacking the conventions of science, reason, enlightenment, and the rest, it's probably more useful to think of him as part of a growing recovery of forms of critique that were overthrown by the intellectual coup we know as logical positivism, and which has since come to be framed as the norm of social science against which people like Foucault are supposedly engaged in revolutionary maneuvers. In this sense, I prefer to see Foucault as a continuation of, and a significant contributor to, a much longer story, one that I consider to be precisely mainstream, and in relation to which much of contemporary social science is an undoubtedly powerful, but often dogmatic, that is, uncritical or pre-critical reaction. This longer story is indeed one that concerns the legacy of Kant, though not of the Kantian ethical theory that has been predominant in the Anglo-American world since the 50s. Kant and the possibility of critique, in the wake of the collapse of the transcendental guarantees assumed by Kant himself, as well as of the many problems that confronted various neo-Kantian attempts to understand the constitution of human knowing as a purely immanent, that is, historical process. This brief comment may be already enough to signal that I do not think of Foucault in many of the ways in which he appears to have been framed in popular debate in the Anglo-American world. Foucault does not appear to me as part of a story centered only on Paris, or as a character in some generalized postmodernity. Rather, he appears to me in two sorts of stories. One about the history of medicine, one that expands on one that expands as our understanding of what it means to be embodied expands. And one about the continuing struggle to engage with Kantian accounts of modern subjectivity, recognizing the problems inherent in Hegelian, Marxian, Nietzschean, and phenomenological attempts to improve on Kant. That is, I read Foucault as struggling to, in some sense, keep Kant without buying into various attempts to improve on Kant, and I think in four in particular, without buying into the reified teleology of a linear history associated with Hegel, I say associated with Hegel. Two, without buying into the reductionist account of ideology associated with Marx, or at least Marxian Marxism, and hence questions about Gramsci and so on, and hence his attempt to think through power knowledge in a way which does not fall foul of the reductionist theory of ideology. Perhaps more important than that, without buying into Husserl's phenomenology and its hope to recover the hidden depths beneath the surface of things through a hermeneutics and a trans-historical subject. Husserl may be a name unfamiliar to you, but I think is absolutely crucial to understanding the way in which Foucault's early work was constructed. I may come back to it. And finally, without accepting the Nietzschean account of the world of tragedy, it was forever exterminated by Socrates and the Christians, even though Socrates and the Christians built upon the tragic in order to construct their accounts of a unity that could keep difference and tragedy under control. I'll come back to that. Most commentators also want to put Heidegger in there somewhere. I think it's a crucial thing to do. I simply don't quite understand myself how to put Heidegger into that particular analysis. Has Foucault escaped from these four moves that he tries to resist? I think yes and no. No and yes. And one could talk about each of the four. In any case, in each, despite all of these names, Kant remains absolutely central. In the very early, I don't know where this quotation comes from, but once he did once say, I understand, we are all neo-Kantians now. And it's a phrase that resonates. But what does it mean? Everyone will agree that Foucault is engaged in worrying through the status of what we call the modern subject. At one point he started talking about the end of the era of man, and another he started to worry about the techniques of a selfhood that had clearly not been erased. It's often also said that he shifted from an archaeological concern with the conditions under which subjects can speak truth to a genealogical claim, that truth as such is the possibility condition for the construction of the modern self as subject. He certainly refuses the account of a self that is somehow always self-identical to itself. And he is certainly concerned with the conditions under which individuals constitute themselves as subjects, that is, under which their subjectivity is enabled, or it emerges, or it becomes something other than it was before. It is a subjectivity that is precisely subject, internal, and yet becoming other, somehow external to itself, other than it was in the previous objectification. In this, he has much in common with many other figures, and for me, the resonances with Max Weber are absolutely central, even though there's much controversy as to how far Foucault himself is explicitly taking on Weber. It strikes me that they are very similar articulations of a problem and very different resolutions of the problem, although perhaps caught in the end in many of the same contradictions. Foucault's unfrequently repeated account of his concern is the relation between subject, truth, and the constitution of experience. Just that phrase should be enough to invoke the Kantian heritage here. Let me just try to make four grossly oversimplified points about the way in which Foucault seems to me to read Kant. One, it is probably worth making a simple but absolutely crucial initial point. In the Anglo-American world, we are encouraged to think about the modern subject in classically dualistic terms. Subject against object, man against nature, individual against society, freedom against necessity, the modern against all its others. There seems to me to be no point in even thinking about Foucault, or in my view about modern politics, indeed, on such terms. They have to be thought of as some sort of duality, as co-productive, or as contradictory, or as dialectical, or as I prefer, aporetic, or as some co-presence of presence and absence, some identity of identity and difference. There are many fancy options here, options explored by the canonical figures reaching from Kant and Hegel down to Foucault, Derrida, etc., etc., etc. But the simple point is that it makes all the difference in the world whether you frame the question as a dualism, one or the other, or as an always both at the same time, in the same place, although that's an impossibility. The aporetic relationship between inside, outside, self, other, beginning, end, presence, absence. Second point, Kant is always unstable. Kant is not a clear point of reference. He's not a foundation. He's unstable on two fronts. On the one hand, there's the temptation to cross from the phenomena to the noumena, from the phenomenal experience of the world to the world as such, the world as such which for Kant is strictly unknowable, and thus to collapse into empiricism or history or sociology. We know about that temptation. There's also the temptation to cross from the finite world of the human to some transcendental realm beyond, whether to God itself, themselves, or to the universal categories of mathematics which are somehow defined as the immanent version of a transcendental reason. Thus, there are very tricky questions, which I'm not going to go into, about the status of Kant's a priori categories of space and time. The categories of space and time are, of course, the conditions of the possibility of experience, of human knowing, for Kant. And much hangs upon whether those categories are transcendental or immanent, whether they are infinite or finite. Very complicated stuff, which I don't want to get into at all. There is the even trickier question of making finitude self-foundational, which I'll come back to also. Foucault's reading of Kant is precisely to see the categories as finite. And Kant is running the huge risk of seeing man, the site of finitude, as the source of serious knowledge, and thus risking the claim that it is man's subjectivity, the knowing categories of the mind, that is capable of going beyond the mere phenomenon. Foucault understands Kant seeing in this risk the capacity for humans to become other than merely given in the world, to go beyond themselves in some way. He also sees this as leading to a vicious circle as man seeks to transcend, to go beyond what he already is. I think that's what's going on in the analytic of finitude, in the order of things, but I'm not entirely sure. It is this that leads him into the neo-Kantian analysis of various historical a priori constituted through specific institutions like the asylum. Thirdly, it It's in relation to these instabilities that Kant seeks to articulate an account of a process through which the world, the universal, is brought into the modern subject. Modern subject is precisely inner, subject, within. To bring the world into the modern subject through the process of what we now call development, the necessary march to a greater freedom. The Kant's version of an earlier teleology, perhaps. So we have the endless overcoming through which finitude is transcended in the process of the subject reaching beyond itself, the oscillation of a breaking through, perhaps, the attempt to break through what one already is, or perhaps making do with what one has already become, a kind of stoic attitude to the impossibility of going beyond what one already is. It's out of this route, I think, we get all kinds of fascinating analyses in Hegel and many others. It's through this route we get the analysis of the subject of history as that which comes through the modern subject. This, of course, can only be portrayed for Kant as a regulative ideal, and thus one wants to transgress the great gaps between phenomena and world, or finite and infinite. And much hangs on whether this regulative ideal is supposed to work, or whether it remains desirable. In that sense, Kant defines, I think, many of the ambitions of modern life, modern subjectivity, and it also defines its limitations. Maybe that makes sense, maybe it doesn't. Let's make it worse. At the heart of this, I would say, is the problem of creation. I use that word advisedly. It's not Foucault's term, nor is it quite Kant's term. That is to say, the process of becoming something new, or becoming something other. This is what is involved in notions about becoming somehow otherwise, and that kind of phraseology you find throughout Foucault's oeuvre. It is precisely the problem he inherited from many of his teachers, especially from Bachelard, whose formulations are perhaps better known through the work of Thomas Kuhn, who Warren mentioned. And Kuhn is very largely a straight take from Bachelard's book in 1937 called The New Scientific Spirit. It is the problem that he was preoccupied with Husserl and Nietzsche. It's in Louis Althusser. It's in a different sort of language we're dealing here with the problem of founding, what is sometimes called the problem of sovereignty, at least what I would want to call the problem of sovereignty. It is also what I would say is at stake in the question that Machiavelli bequeaths to modern politics. How does one invent something new when the very act of inventing something new is precisely against the word of God, because God made the word perfectly in the first place. So novelty is actually not a good thing to get yourself into. It involves the paradoxical way in which the conditions of possibility are already at work in what is already founded, the paradox of founding. What is involved in the act of creation, of shifting from actual to possible, from necessity to freedom? This is the question that's at stake in very early critiques of Foucault by both Derrida and Althusser, and in Derrida's own very early work on Husserl and the origins of geometry. And as with so many other stories, this is not a matter of either or, but of both and. The presence of the before in the after, the creator in the created, the origin in the destination, the exception in the norm, the different in the same. The general process is to exclude so as to include. But what has been excluded so as to enable the inclusion somehow remains present in what has been created. So that, for example, nature is excluded so as to enable a modern discourse opposing man to man's own construction of nature. Or in Foucault's account, what goes on in the asylum is the work of excluding madness in order to produce a modern account of the normal and the mad. So the basic move is always the exclusion which enables the inclusion exclusion, or the beginning which enables the beginning and therefore the continuation and therefore the end. I say this is simply one way of thinking about Foucault and freedom, or Foucault and limits. Not to read it only through playing out the standard oppositions that we're familiar with in political theory, but as working through the problem of creation and what is at stake in the everyday processes of forever creating one's own subjectivity under and within specific conditions, but also attempting to go beyond them. In this sense, I read him as trying to find a more effective middle ground between the transcendental and the empirical than was offered by Kant himself, or the neo-Kantians, or the phenomenologists, and all the rest. But nevertheless, is in the end oscillating from one to the other, from the empirical to the transcendental, from the transcendental to the empirical, struggling to work through a range of other problems on the basis of the legacy of Kant's distinction between dogmatism and critique. What can critique be now, we might think of him asking. In this, his efforts seem to me quite heroic, but ultimately working more to show what is at stake in the problem than in any solution. Positively, I would say I'm drawn to Paul Venn's early appreciation of Foucault as a positivist, even the happy positivist. Although I don't think Foucault was actually a happy positivist. I think he was a positivist. A positivist who resists a reified notion of history, who tries to open up ways of thinking about historical situations as always possibly being otherwise, as showing that what is could always be done in some other way, even when it seems self-evident or obvious, and as thinking about the actualized presences as enabled by unrealized possibilities, practices generating specific objectifications that are shaped by the objectifications of surrounding practices. He is a theorist of relationality, not of particular sites. In this context, Paul Venn also has a line I like very much, saying that for Foucault, and he's referring to the madness civilization stuff, madness does not exist, but it is not, therefore, nothing. I think of this line when students say that something is only a story, or that the transition from medieval to modern is only a change from one form of hierarchy to another. Or indeed, any use of the word just, a word that portrays a longing for some solid, even transcendental ground. So whenever someone says just, I say, well, it's the case, but it's not just. And in some respects, I think of Foucault as emphasizing what is at stake in the politics of the word just, only. In this sense, Foucault shows what can be done by resisting the seductive appeals of both the empirical and the transcendental. But I also worry that this amounts to the search for a more acceptable middle ground between what, for me, are actually intolerable extremes. It's my critique of Kant, actually. Moreover, I worry that while Foucault has many important things to say about the limits of the juridical model of sovereignty found in Kant, and about the exercise of sovereignties over life and death in biopolitical forms of governmentality, Foucault himself remains haunted by the sovereignties at work in the paradox of origins. The problem with the attempt to cut off the king's head is that sovereignty is also at work in the king's feet. Let me close with another remark, different tangent entirely. Like many others who are placed in the progressive camp, Foucault works on the assumption of a singular state. I would guess that if he had not died so early, he also would have been attracted by the move to cosmopolitanism that finally attracted Derrida. This is because while he might be able to articulate a theory of foreign policy, indeed a defense policy, he has no theory of international relations. The international is the great silence in one of our great theorists of silence. I think this is a huge problem, one that's already clearly expressed by Kant, but not by those who have articulated the concept of critique in relation to the claims of the sovereign state. Foucault is in this sense a symptom of a much wider problem.